Welcome to Home Health Revealed, where we share real stories from industry leaders about home health, palliative, and hospice care. Brought to you by Velocity. Grow your home health or hospice agency with the power of Velocity. Velocity's easy-to-read coding and revenue cycle dashboards let you grab your cup of coffee and quickly see the health of your organization.
Welcome to Home Health Revealed podcast. I am your host, Mike Greenlee. And like always, I have the great Vanna White, a.k.a. Hannah Vale, in the house. What's up, Hannah? How are you?
Hey, I am great. Hey, you know what I got? A new coffee cup. That's an early Christmas present. I've gotten all my Christmas presents early this year. I think I'm done with Christmas.
I think I'll must sleep better knowing that you got a new coffee cup. I'm proud of you. And I'm super excited.
Yeah, I know. How about you? How are you doing with the Christmas presents? Because I know that you wrapped nothing last year.
Well, Hannah, I'm glad you asked. You know, the wife likes to wrap, man. She's got her own wrapping room. And
a wrapping room?
Yeah, we got one of those. Wow. You know, where basically it's just a small room. It's nothing special, but it's got like a roller thing. You can put a bunch of different wrapping paper on it.
Oh, this is serious.
Know. Yeah, it's kind of a real deal. Now, it's up in the attic. I don't know why, but you know, I feel like men should just remove themselves from buying presents and wrapping. We're just not great at it. You know, you can buy some gifts here and there, you know, maybe for your kids, but you know, hey, listen, I think Whitney likes doing it. Now she tells me she doesn't, but I just think she's kidding with me. I don't think she means that.
Jeff is a great gift giver though. Actually,
well, I'm a great gift giver. I love to give gifts.
Yes, but he's a good practical gift giver. Like, I can't tell you the last time I got flowers. I don't give a rip about that. But practical, like stuff that's thoughtful that actually helps me in my everyday life. Mm-hmm. Or actually, you are a really good gift giver. You know what I was thinking about? The coolest gift you got me.
Ooh, I know the remarkable.
Oh, you know what? That's up there. And I do use that like every day. But that's not actually what I was thinking of.
The coffee cup.
Yes, it was it's the coffee cup. And I actually boxed it up when we were moving, and I have yet to find it and unbox it. I was thinking about that yesterday. Where did I find it again?
It doesn't sound like that was that great of a gift if it's in a box and you've lived there how long now? You lived there 3 months.
I know. And I'm done unboxing things, I think, but I haven't come across it. Well, like, it was concerning to me as I was thinking about it yesterday. Mm-hmm. I was like, what happened to that? I hope it didn't get tossed because I used the heck out of that thing. I loved it. It had the little thing and I kept it on my desk. It keeps
it heated, right? You know what I mean? Yeah, even though I know you pound it like you're doing a keg stand.
I know. I do.
Yeah. But I just think wrapping, I don't know how to wrap very good. I've YouTubed it. I've watched the videos. But she's gone to a whole nother level in wrapping. Mm-hmm. And so there's special bows that she's making. It's like, you know what? It takes the kids 7 years just to unwrap it. You know what I mean? You have to have a chainsaw to get the bow off the thing. And then you've got to have, you know, wire clippers to open the box. And then that may not even be the box. We may have been messing with them. And there's another smaller box in there. And same thing. They got to get out the crowbar and everything. It's a very challenging time at Christmas at the Greenlee's house because we have a lot of weapons that we have to use to open our presents. See what I'm saying?
I like experience gifts. I love to open a gift and it's like, it's a pass or a thing that says we're going to do something.
Right. No gift cards. Gift cards are, now even though you may send them to like employees and stuff because, you know, remote and stuff like that. I think when someone gives me a gift card, what they're telling me is I don't like you, but I got to get you something. Yeah. So here's a gift card. There's no thought in a gift card, Hannah. I want something that is unique. That I want to buy, but I wouldn't buy. See what I'm saying?
Guess I'll throw out your gift card.
Yeah. Something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, I lose gift cards. You know, gift cards, statistically, a lot of people forget about them, don't use them. That's why a lot of companies sell them. So anyway, I don't know. But hey, listen, I'm hurt a little bit, you know. I understand relationship-wise. I guess we're not where I thought we were because you lost the best present I got you. Yeah. So we may have to do some discipline in the workplace. All right. We may have to do some, you know, I have to get HR involved and we're going to have to go to that level, I think.
Or you may just have to buy me another one. I'm sure they have new features
Probably do. They probably talk to you. They probably pour the coffee for you now. Yeah, I guarantee.
They probably just get it for you and keep it.
Well, you know, and the podcast today, you know, just we've already recorded the podcast. It was a phenomenal podcast. We're talking with Bob. He's a legal guy. He knows the stuff. He's a nationally known speaker. He goes to a lot of conferences and speaks on this topic. And every time he's speaking, a large crowd comes into his room, right? It's the opposite of when I'm speaking. You know what I mean? It's crickets when I'm speaking. But when he speaks, by God, he's got everybody in there. And, you know, and I laid it to him, I think, you know, about, hey, can you get a sniper? You know, about mace, you know, nunchucks, throwing stars, you know, to protect your staff. But
you really wanted a taser. I think you need a taser for Christmas, actually.
I think I do need one. There's nothing wrong with having one. You know what I mean?
Dogs you might line
to just taser them, you know.
Thanks. We'll nix that from the notes. But yeah, it was a really great podcast. I loved getting to talk to him. Such practical advice. If you are an agency and you are listening, and either one, you don't have a policy for workplace safety, this would be, you need to listen to it, like continue on this road. Or if you need to revisit, maybe you need to blow the dust off it, pull that policy off the shelf. Because one of the things that he said that really spoke to me was, if you have one, make sure your staff knows it. Like, it would be better not to have one at all than to have one and not use it.
Yeah, no, it's great. I encourage you guys to listen to the podcast. It's entertaining. We talk about a lot of fun stuff. More importantly, though, he's got great insight onto, you know, cases that have happened in the past. He's got great ideas of how to protect your staff. So I hope you guys enjoy the podcast and thanks for tuning in. All right, Bob, I'm super excited about this podcast and I appreciate you taking time to be with us today. And I know you do a lot of speaking around the United States and we're lucky to have you on the call. So we're going to drill you for a little bit. You ready? You ready to be drilled? Wait, that didn't come out. That did not come across right. You ready to be questioned? Well,
there you go. Interrogated. How's that?
Interrogated. There we go. Hey, so I was looking at some studies and I know you've actually done some presentations on this. So when I was looking at the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, there was a study done between 2015 to 2020, where it cited that 117,000 home care workers were treated for work-related injuries in emergency departments. And of those, 93% are female. And so in a female dominated workforce, I know some of that is due to, you know, bodily reactions, overexertion, slips and falls. But what really caught my attention was the 15% of injuries that were due to violence and other injuries by persons or animals. So can we talk about this study, but more importantly, really focus on the violence part of it? Because I'm telling you, we just know that, you know, the CEO of United Healthcare was shot and murdered. We live in a world where a lot of people, live fake lives through social media. I think we're a very lonely world. You know, a lot of people are just ingrained with social media and they, I always say there's a lot of social media dads out there. Right. But this injury in females, you know, are very important because I have a wife and three girls and I always think about when they're going into a stranger's home. There's danger, especially in today's world. So tell me a little bit about what you hear and some of the stories you have and what are some advice that if I owned an agency, what can I do?
Well, there's a lot there. I think it is a good point to note that while violence in home care happens, it's not the predominant source of risk to your staff. Cause it is like with the United Healthcare CEO shooting and with the home health worker who was murdered last year in a home, it's really drawn attention to violence violence in the workplace, healthcare related violence, in the attitude some folks have. I think that the point you made about folks living fake lives, you know, we don't know what we're going into in these homes. We go in, we have very little information other than what's in the medical record. And so our staff goes in there and there are risks. And so there's lots of things we can do. You know, OSHA's put out they put a whole framework for workplace violence prevention, for, you know, putting out policies and procedures. And I think for us in home care, we're obviously in a unique and difficult position because we don't go into the home with our staff. We have limited ability to control the environment. And so a lot is about the things we can do at the beginning to try to learn more, to be more prepared, teaching and training our staff. I think a lot of things that happen because our staff becomes complacent. And that's a good sign, right? The fact that we can become complacent means 99 times out of 100, or maybe 999 times out of 1,000, nothing bad happens when they go into work, right? They go to the home, they have the visit. Everyone loves their home health worker. You know, for some of our patients, that may be their primary interaction with other human beings they have in any week. They come to view the family, the worker as like a member of their family, which has its own downside. We have other issues from that. So in most cases, our staff are safe, but that leads to complacency. And I think that may be part of what happened to that home health nurse last year. She was familiar. She's a very experienced nurse. She'd gone into those kinds of situations before. So I think, you know, training, being conscious to talk to our staff, prepare our staff, you know, being situationally aware, understanding when you're in the home, things to look for, you know, things. I've talked to some folks that are security, you know, consultants. I actually have two daughters as well. I also have two sons, and they've both done martial arts for years. And it's always interesting to talk to the instructors, because the one thing they talk about it's just as much about situational awareness and avoidance as it is about your ability to actually physically defend yourself and being aware of what's around you. And so talking to security consultants, they say one of the mistakes home care workers make is forgetting and allowing there to be somebody or something between themselves and an exit. You know, so you don't have an evacuation plan. You know, most people don't walk into a home and think, okay, if everything goes to pieces, what am I doing to get out of here? Because we're not expecting that to happen. And so we're unaware of that. When we're doing intake, we're thinking about what's in the file that goes to PDGM and coding and that kind of stuff. But we're not looking for red flags about things that might indicate a risk to the family, to our staff, such as, you know, maybe there's some mental health issues. Maybe there's something else in there about the patient's interaction with facility staff. Were they aggressive in the facility? Are there anything in the notes from the facility about those types of things where we might think this is somebody we need to be aware of? And it may be nothing, right? Again, most of the time, I try not to be the guy that's like terrifying everybody, but it's about being conscious of what's going on around you and being proactive to think about those things. And then other things we have to think about, it's not just the home itself, but the neighborhood. There are several stories I've seen. In fact, I was approached at a home care conference not too long ago, because when I do a presentation on this, I have a list. I went to Google and searched looking for cases involving home care workers who were killed at work. And I found four in the last 15 years. I was approached by an attendee at a conference who said, you missed one. And she told me a story about one of her workers who was killed in a home care situation. But what was, I'd say, interesting, but what was important about the case was she wasn't killed in the home. She wasn't attacked by the patient or the patient's family. She'd got out of her car, was walking up to the home to go to work, and she was mugged. And the mugger who won her purse murdered her in front of the house. And there's another case in Detroit in 2010 where the home care worker was killed while at work, as was the patient. But it was a home invasion robbery where both the worker and the patient were killed by the intruder. And the point there is we need to think about where our staff are going, the neighborhoods they go into, because there are risks there from the environment outside the home, the crime, et cetera, that can lead to violence against our staff.
So if I can go deeper here, I'm gonna go real deep. Okay. So I own an agency. We're gonna role play this a little bit. All right. I own an agency, and I am, you know, things like this could happen. So if a nurse is in there, maybe she has her phone, and you know, maybe this patient is kind of on all kinds of medication, right? And they knock the phone out of her hand. And is there like a, you remember that thing, I've fallen, I can't get up, that little thing that goes around your neck, you know, right? Remember for that? Which I probably need one of those, by the way. First of all, would it make sense to have something like that where it automatically gets, you know, the law enforcement involved? Or if I go really deep, let's say I want my team to have a taser or mace and, you know, hey, it's getting violent. They're fearing for their life. They taser the patient. How much trouble am I getting in?
So I've had several agencies ask me about tasers, pepper spray. I had one even ask about, you know, giving staff firearms. And I would say first, you know, I'm not going to make blanket statements because, you know, state law varies. But the first thing I think you should consider is just the optics on, because if your staff have tasers, if they have pepper spray, or if you've gone the route of giving them firearms, which I think is a terrible idea.
I wouldn't recommend that one.
It's going to get used. Right? The taser is going to get used. So let's say we just give tasers. what are the optics on home care worker tasers patient, and what went on there, and did you have the requisite amount of training? Because if you think about, you know, we see cases with the police, right? They're getting sued over tasering and things like that. Mm-hmm. So did we go through all the right training? Was the taser used properly? Did my employee overreact to a situation? And do we have an Alzheimer's patient who's acting out because of their disease process get tasered by a skittish employee? So I think that's something that I would be very hesitant to do. Like, if you look at the OSHA guidance, and when it talks about workplace safety and workplace violence and training, it does mention the idea of training your staff in self-defense. Not self-defense with tasers, but, you know, hand-to-hand. Now, again, are right, you
MMA, man, dropping somebody, put them in the scissors, right, we're gonna choke them out. Yeah.
And the chokehold. We just saw the trial in New York, yep, where, yep, a good Samaritan intervenes and that goes sideways. And so even that can end up. And my younger son does jujitsu, and they go through all that stuff. But here's the thing with the hand to hand is, if I do like 1 30-minute self-defense class for my staff, that's not going to get it done. Like, and every martial arts instructor I've ever talked to, you know, they always hammer home on it. You've got to have so much repetition that in the moment you simply react, right? So, mm-hmm, you know, would that work? I think what we really want to focus on is, again, situational awareness and then de-escalation. Teaching our staff, when things start to get, look like they're going sideways, how do I talk my way out? How do I talk to them? And I'll be honest, you clearly can't see in the video, I am not a physically intimidating individual. But when I was younger, and this is perhaps why I was in law school, I had a tendency to run my mouth when I shouldn't and to say things I shouldn't. And I got really good at recognizing when situations were probably going too far and talking my way back out of the trouble that I had talked myself into in the first place. Having the ability to do that, to de-escalate, to recognize what's happening, what might be triggering the situation, I think is much more important to our staff. We don't want our staff are caregivers. They're not fighters. They're not there to defend themselves. And odds are significant they're never going to have an incident. But when it comes up, it's that knowing how to get out, having the awareness, be able to talk your way out. And then you talked about, like, the I've fallen, I can't get up. There are now, you know, like, technological solutions for stuff like that. There are companies that are coming onto the scene where they have badges that will signal a security team who will call 911. Here's the thing with that, though, right? Again, you're back to, you still have to recognize the situation and be prepared to de-escalate, because if I'm in a hospital and I have one of those security tags, when I hit the button, security's not that far away. They're going to be there in moments. But if I'm with a patient out in the country, you know, and I'm miles and miles away from the police, when I hit that button, I'm still on my own for 10, 15, 20 minutes. I still have to figure out either how to keep the situation calmer or how to get out, because the cavalry's not coming right away. So if an agency was thinking about giving their staff pepper spray or tasers, my primary takeaway from that would be, talk to an attorney, get a very clear opinion in writing, and then whatever they tell you to do, because there's going to be all sorts of issues and controls there, you've got to follow all of it, because when something like that were to be used by your staff, you're going to get sued. And if you don't have all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, you're likely going to end up owing somebody a lot of money. And I don't even know what CMS or the state licensing folks would do when they come out in a complaint survey because you tasered a patient. But I think we're probably not going to be arming our staff. I think it's going to be a lot more on the passive side, and then these technology solutions that come online, how we can use those to keep our folks safe.
Yeah. Yeah. I would mention doing the pepper spray first before you go to tasering, because I think pepper spray, at least for the most part, you're just kind of blind them for a while. Tasering, you know, depending on maybe their medical condition, you could kill them, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I think pepper spray is safe. And I think a lot of clinicians carry that anyway. I just don't think they've ever had to use it. But you're right, if they're in a rural area, you know, the time is not on their side, right? You know, they've got to be able to de-escalate that, or they got to be able to, you know, always make sure they're between the patient and the door, and make sure that they get a first good.
Well, you know, the other thing is, if you've got a device that depends on a cellular network and you're that far out, it may not be usable in that case as well.
Yeah, I would hope those little buttons are satellite.
Well, I think cellular. For now, they're mostly cellular. I've had that conversation. I've had a couple of the vendors that sell have come and listen to my presentations at some of the conferences this year. And we've talked about that. And they acknowledge that, because it's the same idea when the staff's like, well, I couldn't do my documentation in the home because EMR wouldn't connect to the cloud because I couldn't get cell service. Or I couldn't call to tell you I was going to be late because I couldn't get cell service. Well, if those things are true and my security device is based on cellular service, then it's not going to work either.
That's right.
So that's the problem.
Have to be satellite for sure.
So I'm just curious, and maybe you don't want to say, but are there any that you do recommend, knowing what you know?
No, I think...
Nunchucks, throwing stars, anything?
Yeah. I meant technology.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Any of the above.
I remember the throwing stars from a neighbor of mine back when I was a kid, and those never worked for me the way they worked in the movies. But of the technology solutions, I just myself discovered that those were a thing in the last years. I've been working on this with clients. I don't know that I would recommend one over the other. I think they all present a solution to the problem. I think they all are they have their differences. My big thing is they're out there. I don't think a lot of home care folks know about them. I think it's something, if you're concerned employee safety, that's one to explore, because it's frankly, when I saw they were doing this now for home care, my thought was, you know, it's about time. Like, that's something we need. Because the idea of trying to get out your cell phone, dial 911 while there's a situation going on, that's never going to happen. You're never going to get through all of that. But the button, they don't know it. It's hidden with the name tag.
Right. Do you think they'd ever allow for background checks to be completed?
On the patients, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, again, I know that's not the magic bullet, but it is something to say, okay, what if this person did have a background? What if it was somebody that had to file with the city that, you know, they're a predator? I mean, those things are real. Those exist. And again, you're putting people in harm's way. So has there been talk about, you know, doing some background checks or something just to know about the safety of what they
could
be
going through?
Just
that, can you do it for the home in general? Because it may not even be the patient, right? It may be an uncle or somebody who lives with the patient who could be more of the threat, I would think.
Could be, yeah.
I mean, anyone in the home could be a threat. The background check,
yeah.
I don't think we've gotten a point yet where anyone's advocating to create some kind of background check requirement for the patients themselves. You know, I've been looking at this for a while because people keep asking about it. We do background checks for our staff. Anyone in healthcare now is doing background checks for staff, but no one's doing background checks on patients. It's still viewed as an invasion of privacy. There may be ways you could set up your policies and your relationship with your patient to do it. I'm not sure how Medicare or the state licensing bodies would feel. I think they would feel like that was an invasion of privacy. Even if you got the patient to sign off, they'd be like, well, why are you asking the patient to sign off on a background check? You're supposed to serve these beneficiaries regardless. So I don't know that that's going to be a way to screen these folks in advance. And suffice to say, a couple of things with the background checks, you go back to the case in Connecticut last year, everyone knew that guy's background. Like, he was in a halfway house. He just got out of prison. Everyone knew exactly what they were dealing with. And he was entitled to the care. He was going to get the care. An agency thought they could handle, you know, and then, you know, that went horribly awry, and it's a terrible situation. But, you know, would a background check have made a difference there where they already knew his background? I don't say that changes anything. And I talk all the time about how one lesson I learned as a public defender was everyone I represented as a public defender always had a first entry on their criminal history, meaning the incident with the patient in the home might be the first time that this happens, whether it's because of a disease process or whatever it might be that they've reached a point. So the background check in theory could give us more information. I don't know that it's a silver bullet. I don't think for now we can do them. I think it creates all kinds of invasion of privacy issues. So I think we've really got to focus on the other things we can learn about the patient and then the things we can do to prepare our staff to protect themselves and to extricate themselves from the situation.
Yeah.
So one of the studies that you utilized in one of your presentations was a study done in Oregon on violence in the home care workplace. And you said in the study, well, they said in the study that 44.6%, which, I mean, to me, that just nearly half, right, of home care workers surveyed reported experiencing physical violence in a patient's home. That's really high to me. Was that surprising to you? And then what type of physical violence are we talking about?
But and the data didn't really go into detail in what I was able to find. One thing I would note, because The Oregon data was very different than the NIOSH data. It seemed to be more extreme, the higher incidence of violence, things of that nature. And so I don't know if that's due to the sample size, because they were just doing the state of Oregon, whereas NIOSH was looking nationally, so it was a much larger sample. And,
sure.
And the risk with, you know, a small sample size is it can skew in one way or the other. But it still reinforced that violence in the home was an issue for home care workers, which, you know, and they got into some other things in their study about, you know, things they saw in the home, the reports. And there was some there when you look at the data, like in this context, employees reported a certain percentage, but in this context, and so some of the percentages didn't line up. So it looked like there might have been some double counting depending upon who they talked to. But it was a significant percentage of employees experienced in home care and experienced violence in the workplace. We didn't know how severe it was, you know, and what was entailed, but it did strike me as being very different than the NIOSH study. And it's hard to identify that beyond just, I've attributed it to, it's a smaller sample size.
Also in that same study, one of the things that stood out to me was that 65.7% of case managers reported that they had received reports of workplace violence with their employees. And I think one of my questions was, if I'm a case manager, what am I supposed to do with that report? What is my course of action? What's the investigation process? How do I, one, do the appropriate thing to make sure that my agency's not at risk of litigation and do the right thing just to keep my employees safe, deal with that situation personally and professionally too?
Well, you could have tasers in the office. You just can't use them. So you use them.
I think
on
you
employees.
Just want a taser, Michael.
Well,
Michael,
I mean,
just
I think
needs
this,
like a.
I think tasers work, man. I think it'll solve the problem. I mean, you think about someone getting lippy, you taser them, they're done. You know
that's
what
right.
I mean?
That is, it would. You know,
meeting over next. Mm. Who else mm-hmm. wants to step up, right? You know what I mean?
Would you like to tasers, work at Health Rev Partners?
Yeah,
I don't know how that would work at on your CHAP scores, on your age cap scores.
Yeah.
How did you enjoy your tasering?
Right. Well, I mean, that's one of the hiring requirements.
One to 10.
You just like cops, they got to go through being tasered to know what it feels like, right? So every employee's got to go through this. And I think I would be a good guy to taser people. You know what I mean? I think I could do that job.
And would you lead from the front? Would you volunteer to be the first one tasered?
No, but I'd be the guy tasering. And I would, through seeing their experience, I'm feeling what they're feeling. You know what I mean? But no, I would not. I don't.
You're very empathetic.
That's right. Yes. As I'm doing it, boom, it's going to hurt. All right. Rub it out.
Walk it off. You'll be fine.
That's right.
So the case managers, and that's going to be an issue for policy and procedures where we want clear policy. If you get a report of violence in the home, that should immediately trigger several steps. For example, if an employee reports to the case manager that they have been subject to some kind of violence, the visits should be suspended while we're investigating. We can't send somebody else into the home. If I have an employee who's been assaulted or whatever the violence may have been, I can't send someone else out there now, because now I know the risk. And so if the next employee gets hurt, it was clearly foreseeable. And now I've got greater liability. I've got OSHA issues. And so we're going to notify the patient. Look, we've had a report. This is going to be, you know, services are suspended while we investigate. Now you're gonna have to investigate quickly, right? We don't want to just stop serving the patient. And we have to figure out what's going on. We have to do a thorough investigation. And we're going to have to write it all down, come to a conclusion as to what happened. Then the question, once we decide what happened, then we have to assess if we conclude it did happen. Sometimes, you know, you get to the end of the investigation, like, okay, there's something else going on here. Maybe the employee doesn't like the patient and it's a false report. But if we conclude it happened, then the next question we have to ask is, can we prevent it from happening again? What steps can we take to keep people safe? Because that's the question OSHA is going to ask if they come out to investigate. What'd you do to keep the employee safe? You send them back out in the home. So, for example, if it's somebody else in the home, let's say there's a friend that's coming into the home and they're causing a problem. Well, we aren't going to do the visits if they're there. But it's an absolute. They have to be kept out of the home. You can visit with them whenever you want when we're not there. But if our staff is scheduled to be there, they have to be gone. You may come to the conclusion that there's no way to fix the problem. That, you know, maybe it's someone else who lives in the home and they're not going to leave the home. They're going to be there and you have to deal with it. Okay, well, then we're going to have to end services. And at that point, we'd go through the discharge process. And so we'll document all that. We'll have our four-cause discharge policy will include violence in the home. There's things that go on in the home that will be part of our four-cause discharge. The patient is told that at the beginning. We're going through patient rights. Okay, you have a right to service. You have a right to these things. But here's another wrinkle. you may think your home is your castle, but when we're in the home, these rules apply. And if these things happen, we'll end services immediately. And they should be told that right in up front. So there's no surprise there. Because what happens later, when there's an incident, you conclude it happened and you discharge the patient because there's no way to keep your employees safe, they're going to complain. They're going to complain to the state. They're going to complain to CMS, you know, whoever they can think of. And I tell clients when we have to discharge a patient because of issues like this, look, we're going to get surveyed. And so that investigation that explains why we had to discharge the patient, what went on in the home, will be very important to that survey, because the surveyors will recognize that while patients have rights, so do employees, and that we as an employer do have to follow federal law in, you know, EEOC rules, OSHA rules, et cetera. And so we can't put our employees at risk. And so you'll dot all those I's and cross all those T's. And then obviously, you know, OSHA also talks about for the employee, you know, to assess how impacted were they. Do they need workers' comp? Will they need medical care? Do they need counseling? So, you know, if the situation is bad enough, OSHA points out the employee may need counseling to feel safe going back into the home. Because having gone into a place they thought was safe and suffered, you know, some form of physical violence, it may be difficult for that employee to go back into to another home because they're going to be afraid that'll happen again. And so there's that post-incident care for your employee that you need to address well through all of this.
What if you just had a sniper, right? What about that guy? Yeah, you know, say, hey, listen, the patient doesn't know. Probably going too far in it. Sniper. But that, yes. that'd be
I don't think you can adequately write that into your policy.
Yeah.
Okay, OSHA, what about the reverse? Like policy like,
we'll discharge you to eternity.
That's
yeah. Yes, that's the one. So I mean, I get it. Like, we're thinking about the patient care. What about the reverse though? What if a patient accuses an employee of violence?
Well, it's
have
a little
you had
bit
that
different.
Situation?
Well, not violence. Well, I guess you don't want you usually, I have seen that come up. I've seen accusations of violence, assault, sexual assault. And so in that scenario, you may not suspend services because you have other staff you could send out to the home, but you will investigate it because you have an obligation to protect your patients just as much as your staff. And so you investigate that incident. Now, with that will come additional issues, right? If I determine it happened, I'm going to have to deal with the employee. But that's going to be termination. The employee assaults the patient, they're terminated. But I'll probably
also
have...
Well, how can you prove that, though? I mean, it's just one person's word against another, right?
Well, the old he said, she said problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that may be all you end up with. And so that it may be that your investigation concludes, we're not sure what happened here. Now, there may be physical evidence, there may be other factors. And that's part of owning a home care company. In these investigations, it's not like TV. Like another lesson I learned as a public defender, because people are like, well, how could you defend guilty people? Well, here's the thing. It's very, if there's a smoking gun, there's no defense. It's a plea bargain. But in cases where there's an investigation, you're developing facts, it's not always crystal clear what happened. You don't always have a smoking gun. A lot of cases come down to, he said, she said. I've helped clients with investigations where like, look, you know, here are the witnesses. There's two of them. Based on our history with these two witnesses, we know this witness to be a credible, trustworthy witness, and this one not to be so much. And so that may be why we credit the one witness's testimony more and come to a conclusion based on that witness's testimony. There may be other physical evidence. I had one recently, well, not recently, a couple of years ago, where the patient came forward 2 years later and raised an allegation of assault. And at the point that they raised it, the employee who had allegedly assaulted them no longer worked for the company. And so we had the patient's word. We were able to track down the employee. Well, no surprise, the employee denied it. And 2 years later, you know, there's no conclusion to be had. They're like, well, I don't know what's happened here. I've got nothing to go on. And we couldn't even take any action against the employee, the former employee, because they didn't work for us. So we couldn't suspend them or terminate them. So we, you know, you did the investigation and the conclusion was, we aren't sure what happened here. And you close the book. Other times, you will have, you know, proof. There'll be something else. There'll be a physical injury. There'll be some other item or piece that allows you to conclude what happened. Maybe there's other witnesses in the home when it goes on that might be able to tell you, because you're going to want to talk to everybody. Now, mm-hmm. The flip side of that risk is patient accuses staff member of violence or misconduct, and the rest of the family lies and backs them up. And I've said to folks, look, if everyone's willing to lie to the point of possibly even lying under oath in court, and they all keep their story straight, there's not a lot you can do there when it's, you know, because I had a case involving an aide accused of stealing that we were fairly certain the actual thief was a member of the family, but the family circled the wagons, you know, so that those are issues you have to deal with in an investigation. And that was called any investigation you would do as an employer in any kind of employment matter. And those are ones where you'll have to make a call. And sometimes it can be difficult to make that call because the evidence isn't clear. And, you know, you're on the one hand, if I make the call in favor of the patient, then the employee gets mad and I get accused of discrimination. If I make the call in favor of the employee, then the patient gets mad and they call the state. And so you're in this very difficult position of no matter what decision you make, somebody's going to get upset and report you to somebody.
What if you did a body cam? Do you think by, you know, because you see cops all the time now have body cams, right? Because people lie all the time, right? And they put law enforcement in really tough situations. I think being a law enforcement person today is really unfair, right? Because they have split seconds to make a decision for their life. And usually it's life threatening, right? But you have seen body cams work. And so, you know, you lay out, say, okay, no mace, no sniper, none of that stuff, but just a body cam. What about that? Now, I know that as from an attorney may say, well, that's HIPAA violation. It's all being recorded, blah, blah, blah. But what could that work?
So, and the first thing you said is the first thought that came to my mind, that's HIPAA. Like if I'm going to start wearing cameras in the patient's homes, I've got a HIPAA issue. Because everything that video camera is recording is protected health information. I don't have to deal with HIPAA. The vendor's going to have to deal with HIPAA. It's all going to be secured. You know, that's all very important. And then if I have to use it, you know, to defend myself later, you know, in theory, I suppose you might look into that. You know, the costs would be significant. It, you know, how long do you store the videos? How do you make sure they don't get used by other people? Because it kind of put, and then the other thing too is the patient. I think you'd probably have to tell the patient, you know, look, we're recording. What's going on? I think the patients would object. I would suspect, and I've never had this because I don't know if there's already CMS guidance. But I would suspect CMS or state licensing bodies might raise privacy concerns as well. Although my thought is we're already in the home. All we're doing here is making sure, you know, this is transparency. Mm-hmm. And to flip it around, I know a lot of patients who have cameras in their homes. I remember 15 years ago, the first patient complaint I had where they said, we have video of your staff doing X. And we paused like, what are you talking about? And they had gotten one of those teddy bear nanny cams and set it up. And they had videotaped our staff doing, and they produced the video showing our, you know, staff member doing something they shouldn't have been doing, which fine. We were fine with knowing the truth. We would take action. But the other staff members were a little put off by the fact that they were being videotaped unknowingly. You know, and it wasn't like it was in the bathroom. It was out in a public area. So it wasn't creepy. I mean, it was still creepy, but not as creepy as it might've been. So you could look into that. But again, I think you've got to really consider the privacy issues and all of that. And it's going to record everything and it will be used against you, which again, we want the truth. I don't think we mind that. I just, the privacy issues raise some concerns for me.
Yeah.
But I like the concept.
Do you have any agencies who might utilize like local law enforcement if they know there's a risk, they don't want to discharge the patient, they want to provide some peace of mind for their staff? Is that an option that could be used?
That's one that's going to be dependent upon the area you're in. I've had that conversation with a number of agencies, and if you're in a busier area, so I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I've actually got a good friend who's a detective here. And I remember asking him one time we were going to make a police report because the criminal incident that happened involving a home care employee, and the Indianapolis police, they're very busy. And they're like, you know, we'll take the report, but we're not going to really go after it. If you need to go after them, you have to sue them, but there's just, we don't have bandwidth to take care of it all. So they're not going to do a ride along to a home. But if you're in a rural community where they're not as busy, you might find that the police are willing to ride along or talk about that. That was something that used to happen more frequently in home care. The police would be willing to provide, you know, a ride along situation like that. I know some agencies that are part of hospital systems, the hospital security is available to go with the staff. And I know some agencies have just looked at hiring folks to ride along. We'll pay an extra person to go out, which in the current reimbursement environment, you know, you might be able to, you know, one or two cases here or there, but you couldn't, I don't think, make that a standing policy because we don't get paid enough to send one person out most times, let alone two. So if you're in a community, in a smaller community, you might consider reaching out to the police and discussing, could that happen? I think if you were in a busier urban community, you would find the police were, they'd be too polite to laugh at you, but they would be very quick to dismiss it. We just don't have time for that.
Yeah. So, you know, as we bring this podcast to a close, you know, if an agency doesn't have a safety protocol plan, and or if maybe that needs to be updated or whatever, first of all, if they don't have one, what would you say about how the importance of putting one in place? And then number two, dovetailing off that, how would they go about doing something like that?
Yeah. Well, I think if you don't have one, it's pretty important to have one. I always say anytime a government agency takes time out of their schedule to put something in writing and publish it, that's their way of saying, hey, folks, this is important to us. And if it's important to them, then they're going to focus on it for enforcement purposes. And in this case of workplace violence, OSHA has taken the time to do that, and they've published this guidance. So I think it's very important to have one, because of the regulatory potential, two, from a prevention standpoint. Look, whether the government wants us to or not, we want to protect our staff. We don't want our staff to get hurt. And if we don't have a policy and procedure on it, then you know our neglect of that area could lead to people getting harmed. And it's not surprising that an agency might have them, because in the current environment, with the way things have been in home care the last 5 to 10 years, we've had lots of fires burning. You know, all these new programs, regulations, the once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, it just keeps coming. And so you have limited resources, and you have to choose where you focus. But now's the time, I think, to focus on the workplace safety. And where I would start is with the OSHA guidance. They have written guidance that, you know, puts together a framework. It's very similar to, if you've looked at OIG compliance guidance, things like that, it breaks it down into elements and the pieces they want to see. And frankly, I think the framework that's in their workplace violence guidance really works more broadly for workplace safety. And so, you know, you start with a risk assessment. Right? Whenever we write policies and procedures, what's the first thing we do? We do a risk assessment, because we've got to figure out, what are we dealing with? What are we trying to avoid? Where are our gaps? Because the policies and procedures will fill the gaps. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the first thing you're going to do is do that risk assessment to figure out what are our risks. And then from there, you're going to put together policies. You're going to designate somebody as responsible. Like, the government always wants to see a compliance officer. So you're going to have a workplace safety compliance officer. And that's important, too, because, you know, in my experience with committees and bureaucracies, committees don't often get things done. But if it is one individual who knows when Uncle Sam shows up to ask questions, they're the one answering the questions, that one person will be very focused on getting things done, because they don't want to be like, well, you know I said I'd do that, but I didn't when OSHA's there to investigate. So you have that designated compliance person who's running the show, and then you work through that framework from OSHA to do the assessment, to put together policies and procedures, to train your staff. One of the biggest things in the OSHA guidance is training. And it's an ongoing training. We talk in the compliance industry, the compliance realm, about building a culture of compliance. And you do that through a lot of things. But one element is ongoing repetitive training. You got to just keep reminding people of stuff. Same thing with workplace safety. If you want to build a culture of safety, you want to remind our folks, what are the policies? And one of the big things I think staff need to be reminded of is, if you feel unsafe, you have the absolute right to end the visit and get out of there. I think sometimes our staff, because they know that they're there to care for the patient. They're there to help the patient. It's a doctor's order. They feel really committed to stay for the visit. And some might even be afraid that their boss or supervisor would get in, you know, would be upset with them for leaving early. So we need to just hammer at them over and over. Look, if you don't feel safe, leave. That's a policy we should have. And going through that kind of stuff, so the staff know, you know, who do I talk to if I have an issue or a concern? You know, all those types of pieces that would be in that policy that OSHA wants to see. And when they show up, they're going to ask to see the policy. They've told you to have a written policy. And so one of the first things the auditors, investigators ask for is that policy you're supposed to have. And they're going to look at it to make sure it's got all the elements. Then they're going to make sure that you're actually doing what you said you would do, because that's the other component. It's one thing to put the policy and procedures together. The next question is, am I actually doing what I said I would do? And I tell clients all the time, I'd rather you not have a policy and procedure on something then you have a policy and procedure that you didn't follow. Because you have the policy and procedure and you ignored it, the written policy and procedure tells everyone, we knew what we were supposed to be doing, we just didn't do it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you don't have the policy, I can at least be like, well, they didn't know. You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, Bob,
so
this
have
was
it
awesome.
And use
I
it.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked the podcast. Appreciate you giving us your professional expertise in their answers. I was going to say opinions, but it's actually, it's legal to a degree.
It's still my opinions.
Yeah. Opinion/legal/consult with a legal person in your state. Yeah. Well, great. Well, I appreciate you so much for being on. I hope you guys have a great Christmas and hope to see you at one of the future shows.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Yep.
Merry Christmas. Yeah. Thanks so much.
All right.